reaching the end of a very long 2 weeks for us, Justice Portfolio Committee members, for all the members of the Justice family, and all of you are harassing me. I gave serious thought to making a formal complaint of harassment. about what time we'll finish today. That's really in your hands. If you indicate to me that there are issues we can move by, so be it. Steve Slott made the observation yesterday during one of the breaks that we've been pretty thorough this year, alike with last year, and I tend to agree with him. The committee next week sometime, we will reflect on the past 2 weeks. I think we need to do that. And, that will take place on Tuesday. On Tuesday, we will also discuss how we're going to proceed with the complaint against the public protector. We'll receive some briefing on the prevention and combating of torture, but that will be on Tuesday. Well, we'll also consider the proposed amendments. Wednesday, we will look at the 17th Constitution and criminal procedure, is it? Yes, criminal procedure, yeah. Just to inform you of next week's program. All right, DG, we're in your hands again. We welcome a whole lot of new faces, not really new. If you could introduce them to us, people we know, please.
Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable member colleagues. The front row has changed slightly. We start with Advocate Bassett, Lauren. Second is, are you advocate by you, Miss Chesley Bethesda Road? She is in the office of the master, the director in the office of the master. The master himself, Advocate Bassett. Miss Kalei Filei, she is the acting chief litigation officer. I think these are the only kind of fresh faces for this morning, honorable member. Thank you very much, Chair. we will try and move with speed in doing program three, which we believe some of the issues we had dealt with them already yesterday. So if we start, the purpose of the program really is to provide legal and legislative services to government to supervise the administration of deceased and solvent estates as well as the guardian fund, to prepare and promote legislation and undertake research in support of this mandate. We had five strategic objectives that we were working towards during the period under review, and these include improved service delivery at the master's service point, increased efficiency in the provision of services to beneficiaries of the guardian fund, trust, and insolvent and deceased estates, the promotion of constitutional development and the strengthening of participatory democracy to ensure respect for fundamental human rights, improved provision of legal services to the state organs, to the state and its organs, improved policy and legislative framework for effective and efficient delivery of justice services. We then move to the following slide where we give you a sense of each of these objectives of how we performed as against these objectives. The first bullet under the finalization of projects to improve services within the master's branch. A part of the turnaround strategy, and members would recall that masters and the turnaround in that area is one of the focus areas that is contained in our strategy together with the maintenance which we've dealt with in the past 2 days. So Master of Environment has had the turnaround strategy in the Office of the Master of the High Court. Special focus has been placed on training frontline officials. During the period under review, a total of 259 officials who provide master's services have been trained in service excellence by the Justice College. Now, I did indicate that one of the challenges that we're facing yesterday, I think I covered that, was just to try and train people on just simple day-to-day business etiquette, but also just to understand the circumstances under which people come to the us. The master's environment is one of those where people really don't come for fun, and by the time they come to us, they're really in serious distress. So the training, therefore, has a social context that comes through that has to recognize the circumstance. Further development of the integrated case management system in the master's office, particularly in relation to the creation of the paperless state administration system, which we discussed yesterday. The successful implementation of the paperless state administrative system will relieve a lot of pressure on us in terms of just the officials who are doing the work, but also the infrastructure to accommodate all the documentation, the physical documentation. We also believe that it will assist us in curbing the possibility of fraud and the lost documents and other evils that are associated with keeping documentation. The electronic fund transfers for Ghanaian funds were also implemented during the period under review in 4 offices to improve the turnaround time of payments to beneficiaries. With regard to the master's services, we had, of course, like any other area of our business, developed key performance areas as well as targets against that. With respect to the first target, which relates to small estates that are below 125,000, we were able to finalize within a period of 4 months estates that are within the bracket of 0 to 225,000. 95% of them were done as against the target of 90%, so we exceeded the target there. However, as this data must also indicate that it is in program 3 that most of the targets were met in the master's environment as well. So it used to be the percentage of trust finalized within 14 days were 97% and against the target of 90%. So on those two, we were able to do well and we hope to sustain that performance going forward. Performance on other services offered by the master's environment, particularly on large deceased estates, insolvency and liquidations, was, however, lower than target due to, amongst others, the over-dependence on debt practice in the delivery of services and the increasing complexity in matters that we handled. Now, just very briefly, part of the improvements that we are trying to put in the master's environment has necessitated that we move and shift some kind of capacity to focus on those people whose estates must be boiled up quite quickly, because we believe that those are high volume areas. So how we strategize this thing, we set high volume areas. These are the areas we must target first. Of course, it doesn't mean to the exclusion of all else, but that's how we prioritize our business. We now move to stage litigation. First one is the performance on the briefing, against the briefing of counsel. During the period under review, 70.3% of the various briefs were issued to previously disadvantaged individuals, as against the target of 70%. We believe that we're making headway here. However, we remain with challenges of sustaining this performance when we look at the totality of everything that is happening in the state litigation environment. Excuse me. This percentage translates into an amount, because we also wanted to show what it means in rand terms. it translates to 263,700,000 in monetary terms. This is an improvement on the previous year's performance, which last year we reached at 69%, and again we had exceeded our target even last year. So we want to stay on this trajectory where we in the briefing of council. So next bullet point B. As far as the briefing of women is concerned, there was an improvement in comparison to the previous year. As this year we achieved 18.2% of the briefing which we allocated to women. This translates to in rand terms 68.2 million in monetary terms. This is an improvement from the previous college benchmark, which we previous year we achieved only 14.2% of the number of briefs that we awarded to women. And the rand value for the previous year was 39.8 million. However, I must indicate that we are still far from where we want to be in terms of that increasing the value of briefs to women. If we look to the third bullet, a total of 374 million was paid to council from all state attorneys' office. There was an overall increase in council payments of 33.5% during the period under review. Now, the reason why we are raising that issue is that one of the drivers of our business is really the cost containment program. And what you're saying is that we still are seeing increases here as opposed to seeing the reduction in the total cost that we ultimately pay to council. And we're trying to go the other way, but it is taking us a lot longer. Now, we also want to indicate to the Honourable House the performance on cases that were enrolled, as well as the legal cost. During the period under review, 5,893 cases were enrolled, of which only 1,856 were finalized. There was a decline of 2.1% in number of cases finalized in comparison to the previous year's performance. Now, there are a number of reasons that caused that decline, which the Acting Chief Litigation Officer would like me to talk to during the question and answer time. In 2010-2011 financial year, a total of 63.6 million was spent on briefing correspondent attorneys. Now, generally, we, of course, operate in some areas where we not have state attorneys or where they are very far from the court. We then use correspondence. In 2011-2012 financial year, we paid 58.3 million to the correspondence. This represents an 8.3% reduction in legal costs year on year compared to the previous year, but we are still below what we had targeted for reduction, which is 25%. Now, we, as an organization, have considered the 25% more than in fact it is a target for us to work towards. Our view is that even when we realize it is not achievable, we do think that we need to keep a target that is quite robust to be able to work towards driving the cost down in the organization. So at this stage, even though we know it's not achievable, we have felt we would keep it for other purposes. Excuse me. The next bullet we deal with, how did we manage to deal with the issue of cost? Members would recall that we were speaking of the blueprint for a very, very long time on state legal services. In the finalization of the blueprint document in the finalization of the transformation of the state legal services document, we included a chapter that then is intended to address the issue of cost management and cost containment. But it is not only dealing with cost management and cost containment, but it is also dealing with other issues which we believe will assist us in managing and improving the work within the environment of the data chain. Firstly, it some of the principles that are contained in that chapter include the implementation of clear guidelines regulating how debt litigation is to be conducted. Secondly, clarifying the roles and responsibilities of stakeholders, including state attorneys, as well as other government departments who we provide services for when everybody is managing litigation. The third point deals with the setting of minimum qualifications for persons dealing with litigation. In most areas, we find that people are adequately qualified to deal with litigation, but in some departments, you find that you do have challenges in terms of people either not being practicing attorneys or advocates to be able to understand the court processes. And we find that if you have those people, it does assist the state attorney a lot, because it is almost a second eye, as it were, to help us perfect the cases in court. The final issue is during the implementation of cost-saving measures within this environment. We also wanted to just update the Honourable House on the drive to collect or recover from departments monies that we expend for and on their behalf in paying for state litigation. This, during the period under review, we had an opening balance of, which is between period 1 April 2012, and we had an opening balance of 384 million. At the end of August 2012, we were owed 322 million by various departments and agencies of government. During April to August 2012, an amount of 290 million was incurred as legal costs. Now, what this means is that, as we were explaining yesterday, that you keep incurring costs as you recover, you continue to incur costs going forward. So between April and August 2012, while our account was reduced by 62 million, the total collected between April and August 2012 was 352 million. So we are happy with the collection rate, and we believe that we have a system now in the department that alerts us and that helps us collect, and the only thing that we can do now is to perfect the system going forward. So when we are talking about balancing our books, and I just want to close up on this because it had been raised not yesterday but in the previous meeting, I just wanted to confirm one last time that this money that we pay and we collect is operated from what one might call a separate account than our normal vote account. We have not put the pardons and expungements as part of our objectives necessarily, but we also believe it's a lot of work that is involved in these two areas of work. We wanted to give honorable members a sense of how many expungements, for instance, we do pay per annum. And I even think that that's an understatement, but that's the number that we were able to do last year. So during the year under review, we did 5,894 expungements and 703 pardon applications, which we finalized, and some of them we know that have already been granted. In the international relations environment, there are a lot of issues that really, really troubled us during the year under review. One of those issues was that we were instructed, reminded, and almost ordered to really start addressing our international commitments, which some of which date back to 1994 that we really had not addressed, and I think the president was totally unamused. So we told him no uncertain terms that this now shall change, and we are working on it flat out to ensure that we address it. I think we also were reminded by this honourable house as well as other portfolio committees that we then had invited us to tell them what we were doing about the international obligations. I will then come to that. But during the year under review, we received 131 requests for ex- extradition as well as mutual legal assistance in criminal matters. Of these requests, 32 had to be returned because, of course, they did not meet the requirements in terms of our own domestic law. A total of 99 valid requests have been processed and channeled through the National Prosecuting Authorities, National Prosecuting Authority, as well as Interpol for execution. What we did internally in the department, just still a bullet A, was that we were struggling because we were taking just a very long time to finalize the processing of these requests. The reason for this was that in how we were structured, it was too hierarchical rather than just structured in such a way that we achieved this. So we, between discussions between the minister, myself, and the relevant unit, we reorganized. We didn't employ new people, but we just reorganized the department, the unit slightly, and we created capacity that was just to focus on the requests. And that is working very, very well. We really are now on top of our game, and we are just maintaining this system, but it is working. We started off at the beginning of the financial year. At the end of the financial year, it's working like a well-oiled machine. So this part, we are very proud of. With regards to the performance against targets, 87.2 cases were finalized within 3 weeks period against the total target, 100%, which we were able to finalize within 3 week period. Now, even though we were not able to meet our targets as we had planned, but we are now confident that with how we've reorganized the unit, we would be able to meet our targets going forward. Due to a number of departmental institutions involved in executing extradition and mutual legal assistance requests, as well as the time that it takes through diplomatic transmission of these documents, delays do get experienced from time to time. So we try and work very closely with DERCO on a formal basis as well as on an informal basis. So sometimes we get these things via email and we start processing them once they are waiting for original documents. That's to ensure that we keep up on the time. We've seen a drastic reduction of the turnaround times in terms of processing these requests, as I indicated, because of some of the interventions that we've introduced. But also, the reason why we wanted to reduce the turnaround times was to try and fight the perception that South Africa is a breeding ground for fugitives in transnational organized crime. So we wanted at least at administrative level to process these applications as quickly as possible and move these people away as quickly as we are able to. On the year, except the fact that the issues that were raised by the Honourable Howe yesterday and the other day, we are not dealing with them here because they have not put them as a special reporting area. Going forward, however, we're going to put it as a special reporting area so that we report on going forward. But just to give members comfort, we are in compliance with PAIA, and we have the information, the Deputy Information Officer, whose sole job is to look after PAIA issues and all of those requirements. During 2011-2012 financial year, applications for access to information increased from 792 from 215 in the previous year. Now, it's important to indicate this, that this was as a result of the applications for law documents. That we had a huge batch of these applications, and at that stage, I think I did say yesterday that the PAIA unit had not been brought into this conversation of lost documents, so they started to deal with it, and I think by the time they escalated the issue, it was rather late. We had met our deadline, but we are now on top of this, or we are now on top of this issue going forward. And then bullet C, I have already explained on BSC, but I just also want to remind the members that when we are talking about the public protector cases, these were some of the cases as well, which also related to lost documents that were also reported to the public protector and to the South African Human Rights Commission. Excuse me. Constitutional development, we continue to do work through our partnership with the Foundation for Human Rights, and we were funded, of course, it was a continuing project where we were funded by the European Union, and whilst we are grateful for the support and very, very grateful for the support of the European Union in this project, we are very, very worried about the potential drying up of funding in the funding there is. And it's one of the conversations we've been having at EXCO of late is how do we sustain, if there's an absolute cut of this support, how do we sustain it? Because it's support that we absolutely, absolutely need to reach communities as a department. So we are engaging as EXCO, but we are also engaging our colleagues in National Treasury so that even if the funding were to dry up completely, we should be able to find an alternative mechanism. At this stage, we do not have a solution, I must add. The project, the intention of the project, of course, is to ensure that we broaden access to justice, including reparative justice mechanisms for vulnerable and marginalized groups in society. The program to increase awareness and knowledge of the Constitution for vulnerable and marginalized groups. Programs to enhance participatory democracy through public policy dialogue and strengthening of the capacity of community-based organizations. Now, some 4 EXCOs ago, we received the results of a survey that had been done by the Foundation for Human Rights to try and understand since they had done the previous survey, I think around 2002, 2003 or thereabouts, if I'm incorrect about the timing, but they had done a survey which was showing how most South Africans, especially in rural areas, did not understand the Constitution and all of that. So they were then doing a follow-up survey which was beginning, which they wanted to assess, since they had been doing their work, has there been an improvement? They haven't given us a formal report, but in the presentation they made to the department, we got an impression from their report that South Africans are becoming more and more aware of their rights. They are still struggling to understand how to realize those rights, but they are becoming more and more aware. And we believe that this is a good thing, and that's why we feel we need to sustain a program of work. These are some of the projects that we did through the foundation. Excuse me, I'm really struggling with my voice today. My apologies. So there are about 13 projects that we undertaken in this program, and we had targets for them. So to start with, a number of new community advice offices which were established, we had targeted to establish 15. We were able to achieve 20 for year one. And we had targeted to achieve 45 advice offices for year two. We were able to be just on the mark. We opened 45 advice offices. Number of service level agreements aligned with community advice offices in order to strengthen their capacity. For year one of the program, we were targeted to have 20. We came in at 20. For year two, we were targeted 50, and we came in exactly at 50. Workshop to promote the Equality Act in partnership with community organizations. For year one, we did not have anything in that program, but for year two, the target was 6. We achieved exactly 6, of course, through this partnership. Number of CSOs attending workshops to promote the Equality Act. We didn't do any in during the year under review, but in year one we had targeted 180 and we came in at target. Number of magistrates, court clerks attending the PEPUDA training, we didn't have any target for year one in the program. We had targeted 100 for year two and we came in on target. Number of individuals benefiting from diversion services, we had targeted 6,500 for year one. We achieved 10,000, which was way over target. The following year, we still targeted, even though we had a benchmark, but we still targeted 7,600, and we were able to come through at 10,195. We also had to create some awareness on the constitutional rights, particularly the rights in the Bill of Rights. And we had thought originally we would target 100 million to be reached. We were able to, 1 million to be reached. And we came in at 3.5 million, which we were very proud of. The following year, we thought 2 million. We had a bigger reach still of 3.5 million. Number of service level agreements signed with community organizations to implement these rights. We targeted 64 for year one, we came in at 63. We targeted 120 for year two, we came in at 160. Of course, there remains an issue because if there is a reduction in the budget or in the allocation of funds, it would then mean that those communities that we have already empowered may go without. Number of refugees, asylum seekers, and undocumented migrants benefiting from the program. Initially, for program one, the target was, for year one, the target was 10,000. We came in at 10,400. For year two, the target was 30,000. We came in at 32,000. Provincial and national forums between communities and community networks, as well as government on human rights issues. We had targeted four for year one and we were able to come in on target and even targeted 10 for year two and came in on target. And the number of beneficiaries of the program to build capacity for the community organization, we targeted 1.2 and we came in at 929, which was slightly below target. The following year, however, we targeted 2.4, and we were able to come in at 2,600. The number of community organizations participating in public policy dialogue, we targeted 80, we came in at 200 for year one, we targeted 150, and we came in at 300 for year two. Now, we move to slide 114, where we talk about the implementation of human rights and policies on behalf of government. We play as the Department of Justice a fundamental role in ensuring that the legislation relating to human rights as well as the administration of justice is implemented. We've been putting in place action plans to ensure that we implement the relevant legislation. So during the period under review, two policies were developed and we have since consulted stakeholders on this policy framework. The first one is the policy framework to combat hate crime and hate speech and unfair discrimination that we have already finalized. The second one is the National Action Plan for strengthening national cohesion by eliminating all forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerances. And you would recall that this is very consistent with the national, the NAA. In addition, the department plays a key role in assisting government to comply with PASA. And in this regard, we coordinate our work and we report accordingly. One of the reporting outlets is the governance cluster in terms of which we have to report on a quarterly basis on what we are doing on terms of going forward, and we have been submitting those reports. I must indicate though that the capacity in the department to address issues of FADA and issues of AIA really need looking into going forward, because we are finding a lot more issues that we could deal with a little differently if we were adequately capacitated. We then move to this slide, slide 115. What appears on the presentation and on the document are not slightly aligned, but they're not different. It's just that we've cleaned out the wording in the presentation, so it's one of those interventions that we made to make the presentation flow easily. Just in broad terms, we work on a number of policy issues during the year under review. Most of the policy interventions were not new, but we made a lot of progress during the period under review, and I would wish to hand over to Advocate Kosana to speak to each one of these issues. Some we had already had some discussion either yesterday or the day before. Thank you.
Council DG, Chair and Honourable Members, in a normal kind of environment, it would be required that every legislation is basically informed by comprehensive policy basis, so that all aspects that are intended to be achieved through legislation have been canvassed and policy portions and choices have been made around those areas. So as we continue legislation, we basically keep reflecting on the policy choices that are here to be conveyed through this kind of legislation. And as we know, the regulations that are currently ongoing are aimed at accelerating the transformation of the justice system and the function of the justice broadly. They are aimed at enhancing the rationalization of the court to say comparative, that aimed at transforming the legal profession, and that aimed at the alignment of traditional courts with constitution. There are quite a number of policy initiatives which were put in place to achieve some of the objectives. Members will be aware that the minister requested in this year in February have published a discussion document on transformation of the judicial system and the role of the judiciary in a governmental sovereign state, and the comments received on from the basis of further legislation bills that will still be introduced. This also includes the bills which will transform the magistracy. We are glad for the guidance given by this House that we should separate aspects of the magistrate for the Superior Court space as different from what we have done. And I think what we will be following here after is that there will be a very comprehensive measures that talk only to the magistrates in terms of the appropriateness of the magistrate court, in terms of the appointment processes, in terms of how the magistrate commission aligned or be subsumed or be merged or be brought closer to the judicial service commission, in terms of the court commission agents. We are also glad that through the discussion the Superior Court speak became very clear that those provisions that were put on the Superior Court bill require their own legislative arrangement, so they could at this point be nearly seen as transitional arrangements, so that we do not confuse policy arrangements relating to the OCJ, the future governance, whatever, with the Superior Court. Now the discussion document reflect on most of those aspects that require separate bills and legislation, and I think it will be a guiding document moving forward in coming with legislation that are required in that respect. With regard to the legal practice bill, the honourable members will recall that when the presentation will indicate that before the legal practice bill there was a process which was consultative, which led to the which culminated legal services charter. And the process have to take out certain policy principles which informs the bill in terms of empowerment, transformation, admission, ensuring accessibility of legal professions, affordability, cost, whatever. So the bill based on those policy interface that we have had as of other time. And the last, obviously, policy cost relates to the traditional cost base. As we know that that process was also based or preceded by policy discourse that was just served before cabinet, and the current discussion and the further consultations which have taken place at provincial level have helped identify certain principles that need to be looked at, which were basically contained in the initial policy framework that was presented as the basis for such a cost base. So basically, this seeks to confirm that as we move with the Britain legislation, there's a whole process of strengthening the policy discourse to make sure that our laws are based and founded on the policy choices that this House and Cabinet consider from time to time and which are inherent in the constitutional imperatives, as we all know, same change.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I would just wish to highlight a slight error in our annual report on page 56. Just a slight error, but that could be easily misunderstood. It's on page 56, on paragraph 3 on the left-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
What? Right, sorry. My right and my left. And I was preparing myself to get right. Yeah, page 56, paragraph 3 on the right-hand side. In the middle of the paragraph, we made a mistake, and I think we tried to correct it, but we didn't delete it. We said, so we're talking about the progress that has been made on South African Human Rights Commission Bill and the Legal Aid Bill. And we say, even though the annual targets were not met, and then, so there I think it was the editing, during the editing we made a mistake. We say these bills were submitted to Cabinet and Parliament, but then the subsequent sentence says, but were held back due to unexpected challenges. So that's the point. We didn't submit them, and that's what I really wanted to highlight. So please forgive us for that.
These bills were submitted.
Yes, that didn't happen. And that's what we just wanted to clarify, and we apologize for that. We will issue an erratum for the reason we picked up after production. Thank you very much. Yes, no, by us, yes. And that's why I'm highlighting it. Okay. Now, during the period under review, the following bills were introduced.
To maybe help the DG, I mean, I don't think you need to report to us on things we know we deal with, so I would have thought that that slide you could proceed.
That's true. Yeah, that's right.
That was bills that with Parliament.
Bills that are with us.
Yes.
But then we have some that are still...
So we know about, on slide 117, we know about legal practice and we know about torture, but you might want to tell us about the Human Rights Commission Bill. I'm sure members are interested in the Remuneration Commission Bill. I think those,
Those are of interest.
Thank you very much. I mean, you can't blame me. I would request Advocate Aslett to take us through the specifics of the bills and let us you have the instructions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the first two slides are really a factual situation and the committee members do know about it. On slide... Maybe we can go to slide 117. These are bills that we have worked on during the year under discussion, although they did not all reach Parliament in the year under discussion. We worked hard on the legal practice, we know where it is, and we worked hard on the torture bill. and they were introduced to Parliament in the financial year that we are in at the moment. The South African Human Rights Commission Bill, this is a bill that, in fact, I think it went to Canada Committee yesterday, and I'm sure it will be coming to this committee very shortly. It is in large, I don't know whether you want me to go into details about the contents of the bill, or should not. We've got our usual judicial matters, and this is going to be a Second Amendment bill. We worked hard on that. It's a bill of about 50 clauses, and I think that's going to go to, it didn't go to Cabinet Committee yesterday. I think it's going towards the end of October, beginning November. That is ready. And that also hopefully be introduced before this year is out. The determination of remuneration of commissioners of Chapter 9 institutions. That is also, it should have gone to Cabinet Committee yesterday for some other reason. It didn't, so it's going to be going to the Cabinet Committee very shortly. That deals with, and let me just get my wording correctly there, intended to address disparities in the remuneration of commissioners of various Chapter 9 institutions to bring them in so that there's consistency as far as that's concerned. I don't know, you say, let's not go into detail, if I can leave it there. We're ready with the legal aid bill. I'm in fact just proofreading the final bit, and I'm hoping to submit it to our ETN minister within the next week or so. The criminal procedure amendment bill, that's something that you'll have. No, that's not that one. It's a bill that amends the criminal procedure, and it deals with two reports of the South African Law Commission, a right to appeal by the prosecution on questions of fact and out-of-court settlements. That is also on our table, and I'm hoping to get it to the DG and Minister within the next week or so. Then we also, I can make mention on the next slide, that bills that are under consideration is the Muslim Marriage Bill, and that's a really complex issue, and we are evaluating comments that have been received. There's a lot of opposition to the bill for obvious reasons, and they're saying that government shouldn't be legislating on religious issues. The prohibition of racism, hate speech, xenophobia and related intolerance, well, that's related to the policy framework that RDD has just spoken about, that's been finalised. If the policy framework's finalised, now the policy framework will inform contents of the bill, and we're going to move with that. The National Prosecuting Authority Amendment Bill is a bill that is intended to delink the NPA from the Department of Justice. The bill has been prepared and is submitted to the NPA, and we are waiting for their comments. And the Protected Disclosures Amendment Bill is also a bill that comes from an investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission, and it's intended to broaden the scope of protected disclosures so that it isn't only limited to employees in the conventional sense of the word, and to broaden it beyond employees in the conventional sense. I think that brings us to the end of the bills. On subordinate legislation, I can just mention in passing, there were 11 proclamations that were published by the SIU in the year under discussion, and a further 5 were under consideration by the end of March 2012. And then other regulations that were published in the year under consideration, I've mentioned them, it's regulations under the Attorneys Act relating to investment of money in the Attorney Stability Fund, practical guidelines for employees under the Protected Disclosures Act, regulations under the Sheriff's Act, those are very technical amendments, and I can make copies available of all these, although I think the lists were tabled, the lists of the regulations were tabled in Parliament in terms of the Interpretation Act. But if members do want to see these regulations, we can make them available. Then there were regulations under the Administration of Estates Act, which really just adapted the tariff payable to appraisers. Regulations under the Magistrates Act, 93, they were published in January, and they deal with maternity leave, adoption leave, and family responsibility leave for magistrates. There, what it boiled down to, it was bringing those regulations in line with the leave dispensation of public servants. And then 2 sets of proclamations and notices in terms of our video audiovisual linkage legislation were implemented in terms of which video conferencing or postponement by means of audiovisual linkage could take place in a number of ministerial districts. So I think that from the bills and regulation perspective is a summary of our activities this year. I don't know whether I should possibly mention, I mentioned it with the chair this morning, an outstanding issue that the committee might want to consider is the issue of the budget code that still needs to be finalized. And I can also mention that the fingerprint legislation, it's the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill, SAPs have come and told us that they're ready to implement now. They've got the necessary resources and got their systems in place. So we are in the process of implementing that piece of legislation, and we are suggesting that it comes into operation. The President puts the operation on the 30th of November, and that date has been consulted with SAPs. And 30th of November. I think there was something else that I wanted to raise. This is the time of the year that we normally do our legislative program. We get a request from the leader of government business to submit our legislative program to them for planning purposes for next year's legislative program, and I wondered whether the committee might want to hear what we have in mind with the approval of the VG before we take it to the minister. It would also help assist us. Thank you.
DG, let me take this question. Mr. Jeffrey.
your post thingy. Nobody explained to me about the missing 1,000 grand from the lower court.
And can we address the point raised by Mr. Bassett about
the legislative program is a little bit of a pipe dream. Well, the legislative program of the Department of Justice is a little bit of a pipe dream. I think we would be satisfied if we get these bills that are spoken about, the Human Rights Commission amendment, the Judicial Matters, the Remuneration Commission of Remuneration, and the NPA one, and that legal aid. So I don't know if there's much more, but I would imagine, Chair, that would be the next Parliament that would be looking at those other bills that Mr. Bassett is going to speak about.
Ms. Schaefer.
Could I know what Mr. Bassett is saying?
And would it not be better as a written document? I mean, I'm not trying to hide anything, but it's just more, I'm just saying the practical arrangement.
Good to hear you, Mr. Bassett. Thank you, Chair. Yes, we have to acknowledge that we have a taxing legislative program every year, but I would like to make the point when our minister does admit it, he recognises and accepts that our program is ambitious, and that there's always a request, and I'm trying to get the wording that we use within parliamentary time to try and deal with as many of these bills as is possible, realising that we're not going to get through the entire our wish list.
What exactly is the performance on the bills? I mean, 20%?
Yeah.
We haven't met our targets, all of our targets, and that is a fact. I think that's the approach that we've adopted. We try and get through as many as possible, because we do come under pressure from all the role players and stakeholders to see that the legislation is moving. It's quite a difficult balancing act. If I may just, and here again, you're going to see there's a long list that we have. In addition, we would like to see the judicial matters that I've already mentioned introduced during the course of this year, the Human Rights Commission introduced. The remuneration of Chapter 9 commissioners we would like to see introduced. I think some of the things that are going to stand over for next year, we're under pressure for an NIRD. We would like to see this, particularly, and I mentioned it first, as a third-party fungible. We've already drafted something and we're in consultation with the Chief CFO, and we want to go and discuss it with the National Treasury as well, so that is a priority. We've got a whole number of amendments to the Maintenance Act that we would like to promote, and the question, we've already got them in a Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, but this is growing, and the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill is growing, and our question and your guidance would be appreciated, should we come with a separate Maintenance Amendment Bill, or do we plug it into the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill? The hate speech, I've already mentioned, the NPA, I've already mentioned. There's huge pressure from us from the Debt Collectors Council to come up with an amendment bill there. We are in the initial stages of preparing the bill. We've got a first draft. And then we've also come, and your guidance here would also assist when we approach the minister, is there's enormous pressure from the Law Society of South Africa for us to come with an attorney's amendment bill. There are a range of issues that they have, technical issues that they're raising, and they're saying, please, let's go with this bill. We realize that there is already a legal practice within Parliament, and they are pressurizing us to come up with an attorney's amendment bill dealing with, I think, three issues. The insolvency bill that's been in waiting for a long time, I think we're also getting to a stage where we're going to be able to approach Cabinet soon, and we would like to see that on the legislative program. We are under pressure to come up with an extradition bill. We've got a first draft that I'm looking at there, and that's also an entirely new extradition bill to revise the old bill, the old act that we have now, and to try and sort out some of the challenges that are experienced in practice. I've mentioned the Muslim Marriages Bill, and then I also just mentioned that I think we're going to have to have a legislation dealing with court administration and the Office of the Chief Justice. And possibly a domestic violence amendment bill. When we did the harassment legislation last year, I think this committee at some stage indicated that it would be a good idea to bring the innovations that we've got in that harassment bill into the Domestic Violence Act, and we've got a first draft of a bill of that nature as well, which we would like to see promoted. Yes, I think that is our wish list, and I realize it is a long wish list.
Right. Comes so low down in your hierarchy of mission, but that surely has a certain mundane purpose. When may we have it?
Colleagues would help Mr. Susana.
The DGFA indicated early next year. So it's one of the that steps may come toward the end of the financial year or beginning of the financial year. Yeah.
The determination of remuneration of commissioners of Chapter 9, the institution's bill, does it look at the situation of the deputy public protector?
Yes. Can I confirm? I'm sure it does. I don't have that detail here, but as far as I can recall, it does.
On the entire presentation. All right. Are we done with Mr. Bassett?
Deputy Public Protector, though, I mean, that appointment is made by the National Assembly, so it should be covered, and if it's not, it would need to be put in.
Yeah. It's a problem. All right. Then, DG, before we move on to Mr. Johnson, with the budget outcomes of Program B, Meadows, do you want to... Well, let's hear Mr. Johnson.
DG? Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to address the budget that is open when you process through some of the comments that they are making. Overall expense of this program and the service within this program is 697 million. The initial budget was around about 720 million. Within the rooms, we shifted some money from this program. Now, I think maybe we might should try to get a bit better here because, I mean, there's substantial strength in the master's office. You know, they are making commitments that people with excess master services at core level now. the court level demands public parameters and schemes to assist the process. So maybe in that year we are responsible savings. I'm willing to need to get with the master and the founder of the museum and rather make those funding. It's the 20 million rand would be if you allocated somewhere else, made it available for services within the program. So overall, 697 million rand expenditure. The next slide will show you, manager, one line item on the next slide, the manager would want while. If you look at goods and services operational expenditure, with this budget cut, the goods and services budget decreased from 126 million to 92 million. Everybody called upon in Amanda specifically, when I observed there was substantial effort to reduce budgets to officers and it made the management a bit difficult, the lack of operational budget. But now we can see, in the goods and services, how do we procure the scanners and the printers to allow for enhancing the services in this office? The next slide, the last point that I want to make is, just to give you a breakdown of the 697 million. Now, there you can see the state law advisors and the chief litigation officer, and the biggest component is 350 million, master of the High Court. Because they surely believe again from a budget review, and in perspective they were not successful, and surely hope to improve. The initial budget for constitutional development was nearly 50 million rand, and because of the delays in the appointment in the area, before we eventually spent 10 million, and through the process we generated 20 million in savings that I propose that you should use within the program instead of funding other programs. You know, the money isn't going for security, but it's when my point together with the founding office and the chief master is that we must try to contain this money, to keep this money to enhance efficiency in the master services. Thank you, sir.
Sorry, Mr. Chief, always wants to be first, and now he's in this way. I think it was just 25% reduction in targets for legal costs. I mean, it's already well saying you want to robust target, but I mean, I would suspect that it's probably also necessary to, I mean, I don't think it's essential that you have to cut no matter what, because you're going to end up spending somewhere else. So, I mean, either you're going to have to open up state attorney's offices there in the other area where you don't have, or otherwise. So I would, you know, I'm going to make a general point later, but I'll do it now, because 72% of your targets have not been met. It's quite clear that you have made a lot of progress in the department. And I don't think it does you justice to have, I mean, it's a due credit to think that you want to have an excellent target, but I think maybe you need to relook at your target taking, because you have definitely made progress. And I don't think it's fair towards the department and UDG, who I know is clearly doing a lot of work, that to have a report to show that kind of thing, because that's all people look at. They don't look at all the details. And I think you really need to look at the realistic enough to get such a rate of your targets. Then I just want to ask, I've been informed on your international obligations that today in the ATC there is the withdrawal of the Cybercrime Convention ratification request. Why? You obviously don't know them. Hang on, I don't think I'm missing. And then, well, that was just a concern. Mr. Bassett, I just mentioned yesterday to the DD, and I just wanted to do it again while you're here as well, if you've noticed you specifically mentioned maintenance, is that I have been informed that the Australian system is quite useful to look at. And if we're going to do an amendment to bill of maintenance, perhaps if that could be looked at, because I understand it's got something to do with government percentages. If you earn X amount of money, you pay X amount of maintenance. So I think that might be quite useful to address issues of people fabricating and manufacturing large expenses to avoid paying the obligation. And then, yeah, I think that's all for now. Just on the PIA, maybe, I mean, I was thinking, we were discussing the other day, and I don't know what the rest of the committee thinks, but the problem with PIA is that for some reason or other, the legislators at the time included a provision that it can't be implemented without the training of magistrates. Now, surely the most logical thing would be to take out the requirement so that it can be implemented. And could we not do that in a general law amendment, maybe?
It didn't necessarily support the training provision, but I didn't like the way eagerness the DD responded with her facial expressions on that point, but I'll come back to Chaya. First point, just a general one. DG, we've got two Hollywoods. It's chief litigation, and then what's Mr. Bassett's acting position? Legislative development. Now, how long have they been those positions been vacant for? In the case of chief, was it Mr. Bassett? Legislative development, I mean, it was Mr. Rudman's position. Mr. Rudman was threatening to retire for years. I mean, I think he retired late, but he kept on telling us year after year he was going to retire. So I don't think you could have been shocked, DG, that Mr. Rudman finally retired. And it just is, I don't know, you know, we've got the same problem with the FT Public Protector. For some reason, Parliament relies on a letter from the minister to inform Parliament that the position is vacant or the term is ending. Everybody knows the term is ending end of November, but we have to sort of push and shove and the letter finally comes, but we're now like under quite a lot of time pressure. Why doesn't the department, why is the department not more proactive in filling these vacancies? Anyway, okay. Pastor's after took not much to say. The public protector told us that she has a lot of complaints. I think her statistics were like about 54. We asked her to give us the details of what were those complaints about. Unfortunately, she didn't bless us with that information, so I can't put that to the master. I think the only thing to say is that, and then we know the SIU investigation, I think the only thing to note is that the targets were achieved, that is good. Just the rollout of the extension of the access to the Guardian's fund facilities. You know, I think there was Mr. Johnson, I think, made references that that may be curtailed due to the cuts. That, you know, I think the existing position where everybody in Gauteng, particularly the most populous area of Joburg, has to go to Pretoria. They can't access anything from Johannesburg. But in the Eastern Cape, that you've all got to go, whether you're from Atatiel or Port Elizabeth, you've all got to go to Grahamstown, cannot continue. You did give us a report. Unfortunately, we didn't get the Annexure F1. This is now your July report on the rollout, but we are assuming it's there. But I think just to emphasize, and I think we should maybe say something about it here in our report, that this extension to the Guardians, the Guardians Fund accessibility should not be curtailed. And there must be ways of making it not that expensive. I mean, sticking somebody in Master's office who has got some training, who will receive documents, give advice, and send the documents through. And even with General Master's service at Magistrates Courts. So that's all I want to say around the Master. And as far as state litigation, your July report, follow-up report, spoke about amendments to court rules on alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And it was quite detailed, but, you know, the Rules Board was going to meet in August after the report. What is happening with that amendment? The performance on council briefing, last year you gave us a report on the success or loss rate. Can we get that again this year? In terms of how many cases were won, how many cases were lost, how many were settled. One of the issues, just to say, to me it's not just number, it's also the training. And I'm quite pleased that with this current round of JSC interviews, that the role that somebody from a advanced community has played in training, mentoring advocates from disadvantaged communities has come up, and I think that is very useful. I mean, the point has been raised, Chair, if Advocate Owen Rogers gets appointed, there's going to be a huge loss of expertise at the bar on those financial matters. Has he trained people? I mean, that's not a question for Dee Dee, that's just a comment.
Yeah.
No, what I'm just saying is, to me, as far as the council briefing and transformation of the bar, it's not just a matter of briefing. is also training and encouraging the silks, the white male silks that are briefed, to make use of black junior silks, I mean junior council rather,
yes.
And impart knowledge. One of the complaints from junior black junior silks is that sometimes they just get they do get briefed, but they then don't end up getting they feel they don't get adequately trained. So I think that it's not just an issue of the money; it's a question of what is happening, what's going on. Then under the issue of the pardons and expungements, the House, when it passed the Criminal Procedure Amendment Bill at the end of the last term, requested the minister to do. We went for a minimalist approach, which was basically automatic expungements and no discretion. We felt that we didn't have time to look at that. We then asked the minister to do look at the issue of the discretionary aspect and gave him a deadline. He reported to the House, I think it was referred to the Law Commission, or I think he said it was he wanted more time and he referred it to the Law Commission. What is happening with that? Because the whole issue of the minister, at the moment the president has a discretion, but you know, I would personally feel that there's a category of cases which shouldn't be automatic expungements, which aren't necessary for the president to look at, where the minister could have a discretion. But what's happening with that? You don't seem to know, but if you can then come back to us. The minister's all in order. He did report to the House within the deadline. Then as far as international legal relations, look, I think you told us yesterday at the, or the day before, that you were going for this seriously. The Human Rights Commission report on our meeting our obligations was very bad. I won't present that to you. I hope that then next year there will be an improvement. And then just to say that I saw from the Cabinet statement, the last Cabinet meeting, that Cabinet has approved the International Convention for Socioeconomic, for ratification. So hopefully, DG, that will be coming to the Parliament soon. And I understand that the Department will be playing a key role in the monitoring of that. Then as far as slide 111, the PIA Act, DG, I'm quite disappointed there. And it goes back to your eagerness to get rid of certain things statutorily. You know, a whole section of the PIA Act is non-functional. And it's just not covered in your slide. We have raised it before. We didn't put it in the report. So I think we need to put it in the report. But I would have expected the department to, in briefing you for the preparation of the slides, to have said, by the way, there is this issue. This is how far we're going. And it's rough sort of a little bit into the wounds when you do produce, show us slides with the training that is being done. And, you know, that why are you not training on PIA? And, you know, I'm not, you know, it's in the legislation. Magistrates should actually be trained, otherwise they'll make a hash of it. True. You know, so can we please get deadlines and a target date for the when magistrates' courts can be used to adjudicate PIA disputes? Then, on the Access to Human Rights Program, this is something I've raised every year. Nobody seems to listen to me. I don't know why you are. This is an area which I think doesn't just need a haircut. I think it needs a head chop. It's the issue of a lot of these responsibilities, I think, should be performed by the Human Rights Commission. Why is the department involved in increasing awareness and knowledge of constitutional rights, when the Human Rights Commission has that brief as well? And particularly in a time of a lean economic time, surely rather cut that. Constitutional development is something else, to my mind. It's not actually popularizing. It's actually for the HRC. But my question would be, has the department met with the HRC to discuss this program? So at least you've got coordination, knowing what each others are doing. And if so, when was that meeting? What level was that meeting at? But that's the key question. Have you been meeting? But my view here, and it's something the committee can discuss, is this is somewhere where the department could cut. As far as the community advice officers, look, you know, that was funded, EU funded money, but you've now got 45 vice offices that you may have to shut down. But should you have had them in the first place? LASA gives legal advice to some extent with a hotline. Should that not have been put onto LASA? That I personally chair would not be in support of state funding being used to continue those offices. When LASA is there in every magisterial district, and LASA has a capacity to do those things. As far as the legislation, look, let's hope. But this one thing that where you change slide 115, originally it said review of the policy framework of the alignment of traditional courts with the Constitution. It's no longer on the slide. But number one, can we get a copy of the policy framework on the alignment of traditional courts with the Constitution? And two, can we get an update of the review that is being done? And then I think as far as priorities, look, I think that the issue of the determination of the Remuneration Commissioners, amendments to the Commission to the Remuneration Act is a constitutional requirement. In fact, it's way overdue. I must say that I'm quite scared what the Commission will do when it reviews those Chapter 9s, and I'm scared that there will be substantial increases particularly for the other commissions, human rights and gender, which you will then have to find, Mr. Johnson, money for. But it is a constitutional requirement. And I think you've heard that the judicial administration, a reluctance, a concern from the committee about the Chief Justice's office being a department for too long rather than a statutory entity. So just those points. On the third-party funds bill, just a concern that I can't remember where it was, DG, but in one of your reports that you wanted to make it a trading entity, you asked Treasury, and you didn't get any response. And so personally, I wouldn't be keen for us to have to consider legislation until we know what Treasury's response is, and if we need to call Treasury to get them to come explain. So I would really urge that you tell Treasury to give you a response, if you can do that or you can't. And if they don't, that the committee is getting excited and will call Treasury in to ask why they didn't respond. But it may be that legislation is not necessary. And then I think Mr. Bassett's point around, look, it's probably, judicial matters are meant to be a little bit here and there. So if there's more and more coming on the Maintenance Act, it may be better to have a maintenance amendment bill. I do know, Chair, that the Employment Equity Amendment Bill that the committee has asked the House for permission to look at other sections. So there's also that opportunity that if the things that you've left out that we feel need to be amended, we actually could probably, with the concurrence of the House, get permission to do that. Chair, just those questions. Sorry if there were a few.
For the what? Second coming. No, we don't. Didi, with regards to the human rights program, I recognize enormous Smith. This is partly tongue-in-cheek. Your human rights program, which Mr. Defri alluded to, is it perhaps because the department believes that the Human Rights Commission is not doing what it's supposed to do, and so the department is intervening? Just a thought.
I'm sure that the chairman is not serious because he's otherwise undermining.
No. Victimized right now, and understandably so.
Somebody suggested that the department would try to undermine
an
institution which under Section 181 is under a formal duty to
respect the system. The public protector is a darling, and so she gets a lot of money. SIU is a darling, they get money back, so they get more money. Human Rights Commission, nobody really sees, Mr. Jeffrey meant, nobody really sees what they do.
It was not like that under Sandy Colliver and Neil Bissell. It was completely different. This one has not yet established its
a persona. Yeah. But it was a very popular
party.
Your question. If the department is not involved in this constitutional popularization work because it feels that the Human Rights Commission isn't doing its job, why is it involved in this area?
Yeah. Can we stop now? Mr. Duffy has had about 20 questions, and I will keep mine down to an absolute minimum. But to go close to that subject, this is not the first time we've had this discussion. And let me just reiterate clearly what the FDR does with EU money is to duplicate what the South African Human Rights Commission is mandated to do. But we've said this before. And I think that the answer before was that the money, the EU money had arrived, it had been accepted, that it was, this is the format in which it could be spent by using an NGO, which is Louise Oswald. But if you are saying to us that there is now hope of that money drying up, I think that the SAHRC already has this mandate. I've no doubt that the NDR does good work. But it's why create yet another body to create awareness, to conduct public policy dialogue with other institutions, including Parliament, that do these things. And access to justice is the one exception. It's something that we all hold dear as a goal and an aspiration. But, you know, what is an NGO doing that other NGOs can't and don't, in fact, do? So, I mean, can we, at the end, when you reply, have an indication, are you expressing the fear that European money will dry up? Is there a concrete prospect that that money will dry up? Let's have the actual factual situation, but then, clearly, as far as we are concerned, it's not a program that should be continued, but that all that has to be continued, but it essentially duplicates, with the exception perhaps of the work done for refugees. Can I, just on the same theme, say something to the department on its own mandate in respect of constitutional development and the fact that you had voted that money for that purpose, then very sensibly taken the money away again and gave it to, was it to, very good. Constitutional development, in my view, means simply that at the appropriate time, following policy development and public participation, that you will, the department reduces the division, will table law, the minister will take law to cabinet. That's how we develop the constitution, in my view. Sometimes it will not be a legislative initiative, but a policy one. But I don't think that constitutional development ought to be treated as something separate from justice. And I don't think that people need to feel that they aren't doing anything about it or throwing money at it, which, I mean, I think the ministry and the department did feel a little earlier on that they were not doing constitutional development. But in my view, of course, you are, in as much as we do legislative development in particular. So I would say that you don't even have to have separate budget allocations. It's part of your name. And that may sound radical, but I think that's the way to go. Just on two smaller issues that have arisen. Because Advocate Owen Rogers' name was mentioned, which I'm not sure is entirely appropriate, but indeed if he is recommended to attend the bench, my understanding, Honourable Jeffrey, is precisely that he's the kind of advocate who has done a lot of work imparting on knowledge to young people. I think it is precisely one of his many virtues, as I understand it. On the matter of prior training, let me just say that the fact that magistrates have to be trained by is not our biggest problem. It's not by any stretch the main reason why fire has been observed in the breach. It is my view, and clearly the Honourable Chancellor's view, that one ought not to require training for presiding officers. But if I had any hope that the ANC would agree, then we could simply change that provision now in the Protection of Personal Information Bill, which is in the NCOP. And in that bill, we have amended FIRE quite radically. So maybe if the Honourable Deputy wants to think about it, if we're going to delete that provision, that's the place to do it. And now. And they they should be concluding that bill by the end of November. But that's the place to do it. And we don't have agreement on the matter. And after 3 years of work on that bill, we don't want anything holding it up. But failing agreement, absent agreement, it's not going to happen either in an omnibus bill or in this one.
Thanks, Chair. I also want to comment on access to human rights programs and to indicate that I'm not sure whether it was supposed to be the responsibility of the Department of Justice to adopt the programs. I wonder what is the arrangement in terms of the agreement that the European Parliament has actually signed with South Africa, because previously what was happening was that this department was a conduit for money to come through the department under the leadership of the department. And the Foundation for Human Rights would then therefore, based on their own objectives, then contract NGOs to do the work. It was about the cultivation of the culture of human rights in South Africa. And indeed, maybe it would be best for the department not to be directly involved like they are now, because previously that wasn't the case. The program ran, and the department was there participating actively and monitoring with the DG sitting in the board of the foundation, the deputy director general sitting in the board of the Foundation for Human Rights. One other thing that I want to actually be clarified on, my biggest worry about that advisor is that they get resuscitated and they die, and they get resuscitated again and they die, and I think we need to look at how to actually help them get funding that is sustainable. That's the one thing that I think needs to really get more attention out of this access to human rights program. And then in terms of the programs that they are running, I was just interested to know about the direction services, because I can see 6 million, your target was 6.5 thousand, not million, and then you have achieved something like 10,000, 195. I'm just interested to know what type of services have been provided here. And then with community support services for refugees, asylum seekers, I wonder whether this is not something that can be left to the Department of Home Affairs, trying to actually give it a more haircut in terms of these services that you're worried about. And then in terms of the bills that are being introduced, Chair, my worry is you'll pardon my ignorance. When I look at some of the bills, I feel like we're duplicating. Notice, some of the bills, when you look at them, you wonder why didn't we actually just make an addition to the Equality Act, like the one that's on hate speech. And is this not something that's almost duplicating what we've got?
But we're still going to deal with that when you get the bill.
Instead of starting that process this way, let's rather look at whether we cannot do it either way.
All right, DG. And Mr. Bassett.
Chair, I don't know what happened, but I had thought today should go easier than the past 2 days. And now I'm clear that it's not going to go a lot easier. So I don't know what happened. But thank you very much, honorable members, for questions. I will leave all the questions related to lawmaking to advocates about that. Insofar as the questions relating to the master and master services, I will also leave all of those to the master, the chief master. In relation to the issues related to policy, I will leave those to advocates for Botswana together with ADRM rules there, which they, what has been happening in the background. I will leave that to advocates for fun. The issue around the letter for the appointment of the Deputy Public Protector, or at least the imminent, yeah, end of tenure of the Deputy Public Protector, we can commit that we'll just provide that information. In fact, in my mind, I think...
That's come. My
yes.
issue was why did it take so long?
Oh, okay.
And at DG, as you know, the delay was with the department.
Anyway, we will leave that there.
Oh my goodness.
He has, it was signed by the minister 2 days ago.
And it's been referred to us.
And it was ATC this morning, so we can proceed. But my point is that why does it take so long? And it seems that the ministry waited for the department to produce a draft letter. I don't know why they couldn't have just asked me to draft a letter.
Going to be impacted by the transformation of the state legal services.
we wanted to look at what was going to be the ultimate that the minister was going to agree to, and that is why we held it back. That decision has kind of pretty much been made. We've had some other interactions between ourselves, Treasury, ourselves, and DPSA, and we then concluded that in light of these interactions, we need just a little bit more time given the not-so-receptive reception that we received, in particular from National Treasury. But it's a decision that we are ready to conclude probably in the next 2 months on where we advertise the position as is or we move to a different dispensation. So it is really not an error. In fact, in all our reports, you will see that because we had thought we were going to finalize the transformation of the state legal services on target. We then had thought we would advertise on target, but because that process is delayed, it means this position is also delayed. So that's the conclusion on that. The issue around the engagement that we've had with National Treasury on TPF, we have indeed had a number of engagements. So it wasn't just a once-off. Even as late as, I think 2 weeks ago, we had a very long 2.5 session where we were just looking at reporting issues around TPF, the governance issues around TPF, again, the issue of whether it could be a standalone account or not. And we concluded on the basis that the colleagues were going to come back to us once they had cleared all the issues with the accountant general, because this would be one of those decisions that must be made by the accountant general. But we committed to a meeting to get feedback on that. Unfortunately, I do not have the timeline just from the top of my head of that. But I do have notes on it back at the office. Now, to the extent that, there was a question that was asking about the cyber security withdrawal.
Mm.
This is what has happened. We, and of course we'll provide additional information in writing. Sometimes during the course of the year, this year, and maybe late last year, beginning of this year, we appeared before one portfolio committee, I can't recall which one it was, I think it might have been women and children. Yes, and I think Advocate Durant had appeared before the Portfolio Committee on Police as well. And this issue came out from both Portfolio Committees, I think. One of the issues that had arisen was the fact that what we were being requested to do as a country was to adopt, as it were, the cybercrime as it obtains, the cybercrime protocol as it obtains from the European Union environment right now. But there is a bigger movement on the discussions that are happening around development in cyber security right now. And it was felt towards the end of the year that rather than us going through with the European Union bit, let us participate in the broader bit where everybody in the world is moving towards, especially given the fact that the European Union one is kind of very old. If I say very old now, I don't know how to put this in better English, but it has been in existence for a very long time. And even within the European Union, there were members who really wanted something new and something fresh that would look at the issues of cybersecurity and cyber security protocol updated. And that is why it was felt, let us remove this thing and wait for the bigger development in the world. So that's the long and the short of it. I may be clumsy in how I'm answering this, but that's how I recall the issue. We will provide a formal written response to that going forward.
Could the DG Chair, thank you for indulging me, could we have an answer to what were the precise difficulties of the Department of Communications and the SAFs with the convention as it stands? And what were the precise concerns of the Minister of State Security? Because we've earlier this week discussed the fact that the policy, data security policies is floating around between ministries. Never gets properly assigned. We don't have it. It's a disaster. So let's hear exactly what their concerns were, even if the convention is dated.
we'll do that chain that written report. Of course, we'll go back and consult with them again just to refresh ourselves. Then there was an issue relating to our international compliance. We just wanted to give the committee a sense. We will circulate you as a slide. No, it's not a slide. We have a document that lists all the international obligations that we are working on now. We've prioritized them according to dates of how many can we do at a given point in time. To be quite honest with you, the directive from the presidency was that we must do all of them this year. But in practice, it is quite clear that we have to plan this work. So we are reporting to cabinet regularly on progress on these things. But just to give the Honourable House a sense of where we are. For instance, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, that one we've advanced. We've consulted at cluster level, and we are ready to go to cabinet in not too distant the future on that one. The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which we call the second generation of rights, it did go to cabinet, and I think in the very recent cabinet committee. The Optional Protocol on International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Of course, we couldn't start with this one not having done the second generation rights first. So we now have to move to the Optional Protocol on that. And the Optional Protocol really, in a nutshell, speaks to the access rights. How do you go and report if the states do not meet some of those obligations? So we needed to first accede to that one first before coming to this one. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which are first generation rights, we are working on it. We are still desirous that we serve this in cabinet this year before the end of this calendar year. And others, as we had indicated, we had worked on the policy documents, and now after the adoption of the policy documents, we then move to finalizing the convention. In other conventions that relate to human rights, some of them have been given to the Department of Women and Children, and we are a supporting department to them. The ones that I've listed are ours. We are a lead department on them. What I will do is I will circulate this chair for when we submit a written response on where we are on those issues. And then finally, in terms of the actual training of magistrates for Bahia, we are submitting a slide very quickly. Maybe you can just move to the next.
You cover this unless you've got more information. The actual slide with the detail doesn't have fire on it. It's got IJA and it's got the Equality Act.
Okay. Yes, we did. And
I see, okay, I see now, but that is not even in the last financial year.
Yes. The point, though, this is the point that I was trying to raise. The point is that the training... What I was starting to say yesterday was that subsequent to this whole conversation, during the break, we had tried to find out what had happened with the ones that had been trained. Because clearly, if you have 250 at least, those, if they had been designated, we would have had some costs, therefore, being ready to be by our costs as we were. So we went back to check. We found that information, and that's what we wanted to share with the Honourable Committee. And what we also did in during the course of early this year, we wrote, of course, through the hand of the minister to the Chief Justice to ask for a designation of the ones that had already been trained. And that's the point that we were trying to raise, that we knew there was some number. We just couldn't remember what the number was. And it's quite correct that training would have happened in 2009 because you recall that in 2010, 2011, training moved, at least was supposed to have moved to Sajid, so we would not have been responsible for training. But my responsibility as in terms of that act is that once there is designation that has happened,
we then have to publish in Gazette the names of those that have been designated. And that was the purpose of the letter, because we then figured that I had not published anything in the Gazette to show people which court I did. Thank you.
I know Ms. Schaefer will attest vigorously, but I mean, I hope they haven't seen that. I got trained in December, nearly 3 years ago. I hope they won't have forgotten their training.
On the what?
There's a big fire in the Polokwane regional court, apparently, just before a certain political party, MPL, was about to appear on bail application for Rap Lodge.
How big? Very good. I want to break, I want to quickly break for comfort break.
Just a follow-up on your response to on international instruments. How do we assess country readiness in terms of ratification of international protocols and instruments? Because one thing that one feels we are doing could probably be overcommitment, because ratification has got financial implication, and within our limited resources as a country, we need to really manage to comply to all these instruments that we are actually ratifying. And I wonder whether we do take some time to really determine our readiness. And I'm actually saying this because of the fact that when you look at all these conventions and protocols, you realize that some of the very developed countries, like the United States, for example, I don't know whether now they've already ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but they took a long time for them to ratify, and I guess it's because of implication, financial implication in terms of ratification. And if you remember, in our own country, there was the court bomb case where the country had a judgment against them due to the fact they do have actually ratified the Convention and committed ourselves to the right to shelter for children of South Africa. So my question and concern is just around readiness in terms of ratification and whether we do take into consideration financial implications within the limited resources that we've got as a country.
And if I can perhaps in partial response, that very point, when the Human Rights Commission appears before us and loudly complains that they are faced with seriously embarrassing situations when they attend these conferences, and it is brought forward that South Africa has failed to ratify, and then they come to us and say, your government has failed to ratify, we need to also, as elect public representatives, just remind them of that very fact that you've just raised. Did you?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member. The question that is being raised, we've also gone through the question quite, I guess, extensively in the government, but also in government. In fact, last year, sometime, there was a meeting here in Cape Town, the Interministerial Committee meeting. One of the issues that was discussed at length was that there was a period in South Africa where, when we were readmitted into the Community of Nations, that we accepted a lot of responsibility. Yes. Now, unfortunately, these are a result of that. But what we are now saying is, so to that point, is clearly we've deliberated on it at length. So that is the first issue. The second issue is how do we then, when in the pool going forward, how do we position ourselves in terms of negotiating and entering into the right kind of treaties going forward? So there is a big debate that is happening in that front. But coming back now specifically to this one, in terms of the second generation rights, the International Covenant on Social, Economic, Cultural, and all other rights, what we did was we went through, one, the chief state law advisor, our own as well as the Chief State Law Advisor in Berko. Kwame also communicated with the NGO communities, Chapter 9 institutions, and the rest of those wonderful people, just to say, look, this is where we are, and this is the road that we are taking to try and accede to this convention. One of the critical issues, in fact, there's just one that was fundamental. Others were touch and go, really. But the fundamental one is that in the covenant, it talks about making access to basic education a free. So it's the freeness of access to education. Now, we had lengthy discussions between ourselves and the relevant stakeholders, and we looked at how do we, because we don't have that in South Africa at this stage. What we have is we are working towards realizing access to education for every person in South Africa, but we don't have a free basic education in every school for everybody yet anyway. So we agreed that there are two ways of dealing with this. The first is we can take a renovation as we adopt. That is the one aspect. The other aspect is we can actually, it's called a declaration. You can do a declaration. In other words, you can say, this is how we interpret this law to mean to us as South Africa, firstly, and this is how we propose to implement the provisions of this article going forward. And so here we are saying, because as a country we are aspiring towards 100% access to education for every South African or for every person in South Africa, the best thing to do is to take, is make that declaration on the interpretation for us, as well as on how we are going to phase in, but then bring the actual evidence of what we are doing right now to fast track making access to education available to everybody. So that's the approach we took, and that approach was accepted by the Ministerial Committee as well as our JPS Cluster Committee. We canvassed with the governance cluster, our own cluster, the Social Protection Cluster, as well as the NGO community. And that was the only basis we could move with this one, because we were stalling for a very long time because we couldn't reach agreement on that. Just as that one is a specific one, Chair. So it is correct, and your observation is absolutely correct. It's a very difficult position that we find ourselves in. I mean, when we were doing the Hotsa Bill, this is how this whole conversation arose in the first instance, because we were saying, look, there are certain instances, okay, I'm not discussing that, but there are certain instances that we probably ought not have agreed to, but unfortunately we are now bound because we did agree to many years ago. Thank you.
Can we come to order? All right. DG, when we broke, we were dealing with the protocols and treaties and such like. All right. I don't know if you've answered all the questions. No? All right. Okay.
So just a small issue, still on the EU work. Part of our agreement with them is that we have to include their contribution to us in our plans and be able to report on it. And I just thought it's important that when you see it reported, we do report it for fun. It's one of the contractual arrangements. But there was a specific question whether the funding is in fact going to dry up. The answer is yes, the timing is we do not know when. and whether it will be a one cut or it will be progressive, that don't know. And this we know because every year we convene a conference of donors who we are, who are our stakeholders, and we generally want to know more or less what is their environment relative to ours, whether there is an opportunity to bid for more projects or not. And in the February conference that we had this year, pretty much all donors said, look, our funding is drying up, the world, the economic downturn in the world is taking a lot longer than anticipated. Of course, they didn't say we are cutting by period X. So we don't know the period and we don't know how gradual the cuts are going to be, but we know that going forward we need to plan differently. Chair, allow me to respond specifically to the issues around constitutional development and their and its role relative to advocacy. It's an issue that we hold very dear, but we take the members' view. It's something that we are ready to be persuaded, of course, but we hope that we'll be able to persuade you differently. Before we do that, however, I need to go back and take a clear mandate before going on a persuasion mission. So allow me then to respond to all the issues around the South African human rights, whether they're performing or not, and all of those issues, allow me not to deal with those. So, Chair, having said that, may I refer the rest of the question to Advocate Basson? We've done a lot of work to actualize the issues that were raised in the previous meetings on making the Guardian Fund more accessible, but Advocate Basson will now speak to the details of that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Please switch your mic on, Advocate.
I said good morning, Chair, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity. Yes, indeed, as the DG says, the issue of access to the Guardian Fund services has been a matter that has been raised before, and I'm happy to report that we've been working hard at it. We have increased the number from 6 in the past to 24 places of service where Guardian Fund services can be accessed. I do want to, however, put this in context. The deceased estate services are rendered at 400 places, and we are only at 24 places for the Guardian Fund. But for those members that may remember, it was not that long ago when the master had to come and explain why do we have the claimants in the Guardian Fund and why do we have to have qualified audit opinion. And we are guarding the unqualified audit opinion with great jealousy and minimizing the risk so that when a person goes to these 24 places, we are comfortable that sufficient caution has been taken not to create risk. That's why the progress is much slower than it should be. The CFO, I'm so glad to hear that he will think of me in his budget allocation. It does require additional funding for these processes to work, and the pace will be as allowed by resources. And we stay committed to keeping in touch with the ever-increasing demands of the Auditor General and our compliance and so on. The other issue that I wish to touch on, and I do not know how to cautiously enough do that, is the issue of the matters raised with the public protector, where there's not yet 100% alignment with the master branch for that matter. May I relate just to practical incidents in an effort to generate an understanding? Matters that have been referred to the Auditor General, the Public Protector, to the Master's Branch. For instance, in the matter of James and solvent company in liquidation, where assets were sold, all other creditors paid in full except the Zero Revenue, and somehow the liquidator and the shareholder came to an agreement, and the 36,000 will not be paid to the receiver, but will be shared by agreement between the liquidator and the director. That the master would not participate in this arrangement, insisting that according to law the money should go to the receiver. The member of public then found it necessary to raise a concern with the public protector to say, we have an agreement. You should now help us to enforce this agreement. That is a matter of choice. Yes, so we would appreciate an opportunity to where we are at differences with one another, perhaps to explain and explain the master's position. We do believe that everybody is subject to the rule of law, and we want to then just ensure a common understanding or understand that we've misdirected ourselves. A similar matter is that of John Garvey. The person died in 2000, and the uncle now raised the matter and wanted to know why he was left out. But in terms of the interstate succession, the assets were to go to the spouse and the children. But the uncle, in his understanding, thought would be entitled to a reward or to an inheritance, and now raises with the public protector a grievance for not being included in the distribution. Those are the type of day-to-day business of the martyrs. There are matters, for instance, there might be a child of the deceased born before the deceased married the current husband, and the current husband reflects only the children from that union as opposed to all children. And that matter then gets raised with the public protector as having been excluded. But day-to-day business for the master to deal with situations like this, not the master's making, but dealing with family matters. I would require the indulgence of the house to then list the items where we really are not doing what we're supposed to do in order to firstly rectify our conduct. We appreciate oversight, we appreciate being held accountable, but we do also want to say within the elements of the law. I trust that we can soon deal with the issue of the public protector with regards to the masters and finalize that and ensure a common understanding. It is our intention to have a proper agreed process with the public protector as to exactly where to report. Many of these matters would have bypassed the office of the chief master or the department, happening between office and public protector, and maybe there are, and most likely could be, inefficiencies that we would like to then properly address, only possible if we had a single point of entry to, in order to avoid that. I trust it answers the question with regards to the master branch.
I'm glad you've done that. Just from our side, Advocate, we've requested more detail from her office, because in her report to us, she simply gave us figures of cases with no detail. And I've said this to the DG, and I'm repeating it here with the media listening, that we are responsible for oversight of the department, the master's office, all the entities within the justice family. And if any of them have fallen foul of the public protector's office, it's important that this committee is made aware in detail of each case, and so we've requested that information. DG, we've given you some information. I'm not sure there's this one page that we've received that you have. I'm going to refer to it. It says complaints against Department of Justice investigated and finalized. Subject, and it reads appeal / application for leave to appeal not heard / not on the roll. That's a matter that is in a court. There are 528 of those complaints. Matters, and I'm saying this for the public and the media, matters that are in before court are not the responsibility of the Director General of Justice or the Department of Justice. I'm curious to know how she's dealt with these because she says these are investigated and finalized. And which judge or judge president she spoke to and consulted. It's more than alarming. The second one says appeal/court record missing. Now, I don't know whether, DG, that's your responsibility. It is, okay, fine, plus 37 of those. The third one says appeal/judgment delayed. Now, again, judgment delayed is a matter for the court, not the Department of Justice. There are 125 of us. She has finalized. Well, I'm curious now how she finalized them and which judge or judge president assisted in the finalization. And so we go on and on. So a member of the committee has correctly said we'll need to have her back here for her to explain how she finalized those specific investigations. And ahead of that meeting with her advocate, we will ask her for the details, further details relating to the Master's Office at the Department of Justice. I just thought I should raise this because we're being accused of attacking people. Well, if we're going to be accused of attacking people, then let's get all the facts out onto the table so people understand that when we raise issues, we do so because we have a certain responsibility.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Member. There were two aspects which had been asked by the district comment on. The first one is on the rules for mediation, for court-based mediation. Coincidentally, as we sit here now, the report is also sitting on the very same rule. the minister, and on Sunday, this past Sunday, the minister and the chief justice, the head of court, also consider the same court-based mediation rule. After the minister received the rule from the rules board, we sought an opinion on the rule, legal opinion, as a standard practice. Before the minister promulgates the rule, the office of the state, chief state advisor must advise on the compatibility of that rule with other legislation, the constitution, etc. However, Chair, we were very cautious about the rule. On two aspects. Hence, the minister has moved very slow on the rule. One, the compulsory nature of the rule, whether that would not basically fall foul of Section 24 of the Constitution. And whether Section 24 of the Constitution is not one of the non-derogable rights of the Constitution. But the question that we've always had is whether that right can be basically limited by a rule of court, or rather by Parliament or so. That was the first point. The second point, obviously, we have always raised the issue of the capacity and the consent. If the Johannesburg Magistrate Court obtained, on average, 800 matters per week, 7 matters, if those matters must go through the mediation process, we are going to move the backlog from the door of the court to a door of somebody else. And therefore, it means the DG and the department may have to replicate the very same capacity of registrars in the form of dispute resolution officers in terms of their role must assess and channel the role to mediation. And there are also other attendant requirements, the mediators, the training, the accreditation, etc. So the minister also has the rules board that they must consider, and I think the approach of the minister is that if the rule, if those rules are not compulsory, it will allow us an opportunity to test those rules over time or so and clean up whatever may be required in terms of legislation or whatever, while people are having a free access to the court system as usual. And I think on Sunday, the heads of court were amenable to that approach when the minister presented to them. So we will also hope and believe that today's the rules board will basically move away from the compulsory nature of the rules to give us time to do so. And while that is then, if assuming that will then be secretarial board, we should then be able to implement those measures gradually, rather than meantime people and the state obtain the benefit of the rules. That's the point, and I think we hope that by the end of today we'll be knowing what the rules board actually is and when I will get the rules back, so that it could basically move forward as part of the several justice review process. The second part relates to the traditional court and the framework. We do have the original policy framework which cabinet approved in 2008 to form the basis of the Sakai Court as it stands today. However, following the further engagement consultations, we have looked at the principles of the policy which necessitate revision, and we have revised those principles, and those revision inform some of the proposal and discussions which have been ongoing on the base and have been shared with the SOP for their purpose, etc. We are in the process of preparing a comprehensive document around which will indicate those revisited principles of the previous policy, so you can have an updated policy document from the initial one, etc. And we will submit that to Parliament, to your committee in due course once we've finalized the entire repackaging of the policy document. So that's okay. No, soon. And the other aspect that we did not reflect on the slide 115 today are the aspects which were discussed yesterday around the demarcation process. We thought that since those have been taken care of, we should only focus on those policy framework and initiatives as relates to the bill specific, not which relates to the demarcation process, because we've dealt with that, and Honourable Shaver is aware of the documentation that we've started to engage the Methods Commission on. Regarding the demarcation process. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I think that there's a few issues left, I think, on legislation. The question was raised, does our Chapter 9 remuneration board deal with the Deputy Public Protector? That is in the meantime, and it does, so that is covered. It was also suggested that when we have a look at the maintenance amendment, we have a look at the Australian model. I just want to remind members that the South African Law Reform Commission has on its program an investigation to review the maintenance amendment. The maintenance amendment bill that we have in mind is really more of a technical nature, but the Australian model, I think, is a very different approach, as you've said, and I think that should form part of the Law Reform Commission's, and it's more of an administrative type of resolution of maintenance issues than going through courts. But I will certainly take that up with the Law Commission. DG's spoken about the TPF bill. Training a magistrate and that amendment being spoken about. Then the question is also raised whether the hate speech bill that I spoke about earlier should not be formed part of the Papuda legislation. I'm sure we'd have a look at that, but the Papuda legislation is civil in nature. What we have in mind here is very much a criminal approach to it. We will certainly have a look at that. Expungement have been spoken about. I think those are all the questions that were remaining from legislation, unless I've missed any. Thank you. JBC and duplication of bills, I think that was the hate speech one, wasn't it? Yes.
Thank you. If I just, I did raise the issue during the issues, the discussion on maintenance and the DG writing notes and whatever about the lack of figures maintenance. I would just ask if you actually get those now when you do your written responses on other questions that we can have in the same format as in the previous annual report. Thanks.
Thank you. I was just going to
give
some, just to check if we did everything
so long, and I picked up that we hadn't answered this, and yes, we will provide that information. And thanks for reminding us on that. Okay, just going through my list, it seems to me that we've responded to most of the questions. There were two questions that were asked by Honorable Matake on our annual report. One related to what appeared to be in figures not adding up. And I would really wish that we close up on that because we went back to check and Mr. Mpolo would respond to that. Thank you.
That's sure. Thanks, DG. If I recall well, it was Honorable Adams.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the figures have put the one-on-one labor relations, the 61 dismissals. They do not necessarily contradict each other, because if you go to the page of the 85 misconduct outcomes of the hearings, these are the steps of what the presiding officer will usually find in terms of whether you are guilty or you are dismissed. Ultimately, people do go back and appeal and so forth. So we end up having the actual dismissals of permanent employees in 61, and the others still fall into whether you know, the appeal was successful and so forth. So it is not a reporting of the 10-page report only in terms of what the presiding officer defined. And the other one was on abnormal appointments. Also got a template that we get from DPSA, and it refers to the foreigners that we do employ periodically in terms of those with temporary IDs, especially in specialist areas like your foreign interpreters and so forth. So it's just a categorization. They don't want to use the word irregular because it's a financial connotation, but it's just those areas that are not normally within the period that we would usually employ colleagues. Yeah. Thanks.
I just wanted to know, so do I understand it correct? Are you saying then 24 people or those ones that were dismissed have appealed and are not dismissed anymore?
No, that is possible. Because in the state, order itself do not account for those sources. Actually, some you still find that because the person has appealed, some even lodge grievances. You find that in our Uber state, they fall into the 161 that we're still carrying from Uber. So, but the actual way people have exited is the 61. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do want to again acknowledge that despite the dire statistics in your department, I think the DG made a certain comment 2 years ago when we both joined this committee that maybe you'd like to see a new DG in the department. I said no, I certainly wouldn't, and I can just assure you that after 2 years I most certainly wouldn't. I think you're doing an excellent job, and I think you have people around you who are also doing an excellent job, and I do acknowledge completely that the department is looking better. It's still in chaos, though, I have to say, but it is looking better. And I would like to congratulate you and thank you for your hard work, annual official.
I will simply say that I hope you had a whiskey last night and did your debriefing. And I hope that when you get onto the plane now, you have a cold glass of Sauvignon Blanc or something appropriate after these many long days during which you did very well.
Sorry, I meant honourable members. as opposed to my forgiveness. Lord, what's it saying to us? All right. No, that's not what I meant. I'm trying to congratulate the DG now. DG, really, I echo everything that has been said, and we're grateful to you and everyone who's come here to assist you and support you. I want to say this whilst you're here. I had expressed my reservations about how we had dealt with the beautiful art process last year. Last year I left feeling very uncomfortable. I felt that we had just gone through emotion because it was required of us. And this year I think we've done a lot better. We'll reflect on it next week and see where we can still improve on it. But we wouldn't have been able to do it without your cooperation. And aside from that, the engagement has been excellent. We can see where you've done badly, and we can clearly see in written form where there are clear plans to improve on those matters. And for that we're most grateful. And we're saying this, I'm assuming because we're done, or we are. Hey, you're plotted this, right? It didn't. Okay. All right. Well, did you? There you go then.
My ref a comment too?
Yes.
To say congratulations, Gigi. You're doing a good job, and I do believe that you're managing to do it because of the team that you've got. Of course, there are areas that need to be improved, like the vacancies. If you can actually get all of those vacancies filled, it will actually increase the capacity. And even for reporting purposes, it will make it easier. Because I was just looking at all of these days, going on and on the whole day, and I was actually thinking, you really need strong DDGs to be around you so that they can actually manage to travel this journey with you. So especially the DDG for Corporate Affairs, remember my comments about issues of HR and the assessments and all of that that didn't seem to connect. I'm sure you can actually do it a bit better once you've got the DDG for Corporate Affairs. But other areas like legislation, production, the agent is here, and we do appreciate all of the effort that's been put into the work of the Department of Justice. And of course, the Master's Office, I think, is still a huge gap there. And one other thing that is also important in that area is to actually also revisit the location of offices. Remember, it's something that we talked about previously, so that people don't travel long distances to reach the Master's Office. And I think it will actually also improve your performance. Thank you.
Maya has the final word.
Yes. Yes.
I'm impressed by the work of the department. I'm very satisfied. But I do think that there's a lot of positive things going on in the department that we do not necessarily know about, or that is not reflected in the annual report. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of staff members that are doing very good work, and you don't want to just hear about all the dismissals and all those creative things that they are doing, but you also want to hear about the good things that are happening, and I hope one way or the other that by next year we would be able to get to that.
Alright.
Listen, I can only say thank you for and on behalf of the team for the guidance, the oversight that you provide. We really need a lot more of that, and sometimes it doesn't feel like we appreciate it, but we do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.